and welcome to Colored Red Podcast, a podcast all about Colorado true crime. I'm Laura. Today's case is one with a lot of twists and turns and no lack of potential suspects. This is one of those cases that quickly goes from who could possibly do this to pages and pages of people who could possibly do this. Today's sources are Dateline NBC, True Crime Daily, CBS, Original, 48 Hours, and Reddit. Today's case is the murder of Paige Bergfeld in Grand Junction, Colorado. It was Tuesday, June 28, 2007, when Paige's father, Frank, was driving to his office in Denver, 4 hours away, when he got a call saying from someone saying that they're with Mesa County Sheriff's Office, and they notified her dad that Paige was missing. For my non-Colorado listeners, Colorado is sort of separated between east and west by a huge mountain range called the Rocky Mountains. Grand Junction is all the way on the west side of the state in the western plains beyond the Rockies, and Denver is on the east on the other side of the mountains. Not that it matters all that much, just some perspective of where these two cities are located. Paige's parents made this slow and grueling drive to Grand Junction to try to help find Paige, all the while imagining, where was she, what was she doing, where could she possibly be? Paige's children were living with a nanny in her home at the time. Her husband, Rob Dixon, had moved out of state, and they had parted ways only months prior, and I'll get into why here in a little bit. Paige is described as stunningly beautiful, and you can see that in her pictures that she is. Truly a person in the community to be slightly envious of. She had a big house, a happy life by all appearances, 3 happy kids. Basically, she had every opportunity to be smug and stuck up, but instead she was warm and open and incredibly kind to everyone she came across, and was described as a very good mother and friend. She was a part of Grand Junction's Moms Group International, which is apparently a social and support group for moms, and she played a starring role in the activities within this group. She opened up her home to hold parties for the group because she was one of the people in the group with the largest house. And again, she was humble about it and welcoming. One thing that struck me looking at pictures of her home is that she was a fine art fanatic, and I'm not sure how many pieces were real, but her house featured a large number of very big oil and acrylic paintings, and you were just kind of taken away to a higher class place entering her home, but she was a gracious host who held good parties. She also had a characteristic that sets her apart from many people, and that was her meticulous organization. She ran 3 small home businesses and had to organize that. She had a dance studio called Brain Dance and worked as a dance teacher. She sold nursing slings and she sold for Pampered Chef. And apparently, given her social standing, she was one of the few people to be somewhat successful at that. Every kid's sporting event, every appointment, every errand was logged on a day planner that she kept with herself everywhere. The day planner was basically a part of her. Everything in her house was organized into perfectly labeled containers. So one of the first thoughts was, when she was missing, was this was a single mom. Was she just so booked with events and errands and overwhelmed? Was she somewhere having a breakdown? Paige was a lot like many working moms, but one thing about her that was not something you see too often is that she outwardly gave off the impression that she was completely content with herself and where she was at in her life. I say this because Paige didn't have any apparent motive to run off or desert her family. Her children were her life, and she didn't run away from them or anyone in it. So Thursday, June 28th, 2007 was the day Paige officially went missing from Grand Junction, Colorado. What's more is it's the day her day planner also went missing, her lifeline. Typically, when something like that is still around, it's a red flag because the person left behind this thing that they need to live. But in this case, the valuable contact info and schedule in there could have been useful. So it was sort of more unnerving that it was actually gone. She had been in Eagle visiting her ex-husband, and she and him were making an attempt at reconciliation. And when I say her ex-husband, this was her first husband, Ron Beigler. they had a high school sweetheart kind of romance and married right out of high school, which they soon realized was a mistake and divorced. But 10 years after the divorce, they kind of saw each other anew and realized that they were silly kids when they were first married, and it wasn't really either of their fault when it came to their failed romance. Ron Bigler describes their reconciliation as being like no time had even passed. They just picked right back up where they left off, and they had this connection, and they began dating again shortly before Paige went missing. Ron was the last person to see Paige, so obviously he became a primary person of interest in the case. Ron lived in Denver, so they would often meet halfway between the two cities. And the day he last saw her, they met in Eagle, Colorado, and had a picnic by a river. Around 7 p.m., they kissed goodbye and drove back to their respective cities. At 8:57 p.m., Paige called Ron to see if he made it to Denver. She told him that she was stuck behind a traffic accident near Grand Junction, but when police went to confirm that this accident existed, they did find it, but it was 5 miles past Paige's destination, meaning she kind of just kept driving past her house after her visit with Ron. So why? She didn't tell Ron that she was going anywhere else. And a little bit later, 9:56 p.m., Paige's daughter left a message on her mom's cell phone. A little bit later, you can hear the increasing anxiety in her daughter's voice. She left another message on her mom's phone.
Sorry, Mom, you are really, really mean. You said you would be back by 4:30. You haven't even been back.
Then the kids went to bed and woke up to their mom still not home, and yet another message was left by her daughter. And from that moment on, life was going to be different for this family. Ron also left messages once he discovered that basically Paige was missing and had never arrived home. He actually called the house and spoke with one of her daughters and realized that there was a problem, and he was the one who called police first. Messages were piling up on her phone from friends, from Ron, from her kids, even from her most recent ex-husband and the father of her kids, Rob Dixon. And later in the evening of the day after she went missing, Ron, as I said, Ron did call the house and talked with Paige's daughter, and she said that she still wasn't home. So Ron Bigler, the boyfriend, was never really concerned about being a potential suspect because he was confident in that he had absolutely nothing to do with it. On the 1st of July, at around 10 p.m., a woman called in to report a car fire in the parking lot at the corner of 23rd and Logos, I believe is the street, and it was a small red car identical to Paige's car, and it turned out to be Paige's car. Her dad showed up and had to sit in the parking lot watching the car burn and wondering if his daughter's body was inside the car, but she wasn't, thankfully. It was obvious to investigators that the car was intentionally set on fire. The driver's side was where the fire was started with an accelerant. Under the car, there were damaged skid plates, and wild grass was caught in the suspension and somehow not burned, meaning someone was doing some off-roading with this car recently. The front seat was all the way back, and Paige was only 5'4" tall, so someone was probably driving the car who was much taller. The car fire was the point at which Paige, being an overworked single mom who ran off, that theory went out the window. And her car was intentionally set on fire. By who and why? Volunteers, family, and friends all came together to begin the search and do the usual activities like post signs, get on the internet, make a website for a missing person. Basically, just get the word out and get her picture out, and also scour the woods and surrounding land for her, alive or dead. Ron Bigler was not around. Neither was her estranged second husband and father of her children, Rob Dixon. Neither showed up to search, and Ron said it was mainly because he didn't want to be the center of attention or be endlessly fielding questions about their relationship and potentially take attention off of finding Paige. He didn't like the idea of being all over the news. 4 days after Paige went missing, a driver stopped along the side of the road and saw a strange sight in the weeds on the side of the road. There was a blank check from a checkbook, and the name on it was Paige Dixon, Paige's married name. So searchers came and scoured this road, And strewn along it, they found Paige's checkbook, her wallet, a bracelet, a shoe, various cards, blank checks from many accounts, and over 100 items that were spread over 13 miles. A couple thoughts crossed investigators' minds. Was her kidnapper or killer trying to confuse them throwing these items? Or was it Paige leaving a trail to where she would be found? Around this time, Rob Dixon finally came back into town to take care of his kids, and they tried to figure out what he had to say about this. And in this process, they found out a little bit more about Rob Dixon. According to friends and family, Rob Dixon was an even better suspect than Ron Beigler because over the years, Paige told them that she was afraid of her husband, Rob. Paige's family members and friends also say that they initially saw the good side of Rob. He had been a hardworking paramedic and a down-to-earth man, but at one point before he and Paige were married, his dad struck it rich in the tech industry, and Rob Dixon got millions of dollars from his dad as part of this newfound money. And at one point, Rob himself ballparked it at around $10 million. So with his millions, he met and married Paige, and at first, they appeared to have a good marriage. They had three kids. They moved into this beautiful, sprawling home that Paige would later use to host parties for her mom group. And over the years, Rob started to change. Paige's parents saw it, their friends saw it. In fact, the town saw it happening right before their eyes. He bought three Range Rovers, two Porsches, a Jaguar, and a Ferrari in the color of lemon yellow. And not to say anything negative about Grand Junction, but it's largely a working class city of modest sensibilities. And these kinds of cars and this kind of excess just makes you stand out like a sore thumb. In fact, True Crime Daily made up this phrase that Paige and Rob Dixon lived the caviar life in a corn dog town. No offense to my Grand Junction listeners of corn dog town. I love corn dogs. Rob Dixon would never show up to family events, and Paige was very social and happy, so it never really made any sense to family and friends why she had this grumpy, stuck-up guy around all the time. So then Rob joined the Grand Junction Fire Board, and he made an astonishing donation of a new fire truck. And locals felt kind of bad for judging him, considering he was willing to make such a nice donation to a local cause, and locals started to open up to his monetary involvement. He was then put in charge of investing local money for the fire department, including $750,000 that he basically took from the fire department and invested into various trusts and stocks that he described to them as a sure thing. But the money just vanished. The squandering of the fire district money into bad investments was brought before a grand jury, but the local DA and the grand jury ended up deciding that Rob Dixon made a stupid move and made a mistake, but they didn't feel that the mistake was worthy of criminal charges. So he lost public money on bad investments. But the problems continued to come out of the woodwork in regards to all of Rob's great charity and his money. A repo man ended up showing up to the fire department to take back the fire truck, which they found out was leased and not really even Rob Dixon's to give away. And Rob didn't just squander public money, he squandered his own. When they went to get some of the money back from Rob Dixon, they learned that he had none. He had given what was left of his money to a friend who invested it into a pyramid scheme, and it was all gone. All of this drama was all over the papers in Grand Junction for months. He was very briefly a figurehead for the community with gifts and this talk that they weren't his to give, and it became a bunch of empty promises. And then later on became large sums of money lost forever. So for a guy with this ego that he had, this kind of fall from grace didn't go smoothly for him. Paige began telling friends and family that he was becoming increasingly violent and angry with her. And she said that she was scared of him and what he could do. and she said that he actually verbally threatened to kill her on a couple of occasions. Paige ended up calling 911 at one point in October of 2004 because Dixon threatened to kill her kids and have her come home and find them dead. And here's that call from Paige.
My husband and I were in a fight, and he was supposed to watch my children while I went to work. He didn't seem to be okay, so I said that I was just going to take the children with me. But he wanted the children to stay with him, and he said that I would come home and find them all murdered.
There was a misdemeanor domestic violence case against Rob at some point where he pled guilty to lesser charges, but the case was eventually thrown out. Paige did file for divorce, and Dixon filed for bankruptcy. After this second incident involving physical abuse, Paige's dad, Frank, set up an emergency bank account for Paige to access money to escape and leave if she needed to with the kids. But she never needed to because Dixon left her and the kids behind and moved to Philadelphia after the bankruptcy and the divorce to work in the EMT and paramedic field again. The divorce was finalized and Paige was free, or so she thought. So now Paige was left in this large house with three kids and around a $6,000 per month mortgage that she couldn't afford. Apparently, selling the house didn't really get off the ground or wasn't really happening at this time. And especially a house that size, it can be a little bit difficult to sell in that area. So she continued to hustle her businesses and tried to brainstorm what she would do to make ends meet. And she always worried that Rob Dixon would try to come back into her life because she would rather struggle alone in that home to make that outrageous mortgage payment than have Rob come back and subject her to the psychological and occasionally physical abuse that she had gone through. So a week before she disappeared, who called her but none other than Rob Dixon to tell her that she was coming back into town because he missed the kids. Paige sat with friends and they discussed what this meant and what they might do, and within days, Paige was missing. So the investigation is continuing on, and with still no signs of Paige, investigators focused on Ron and Rob, her two ex-husbands. Ron, the man who last saw her, and Rob, the man who threatened to murder their children and have her walk in to find their dead bodies. Investigators had one ace up their sleeve, and that was a piece of evidence that they didn't even tell Paige's parents they had found. Inside the burned-out car, one thing survived, and that was Paige's beloved day planner, because the melted dash had actually fallen down on it and protected it from the fire. June 26th through the 29th, the days that Paige went missing, they were ripped out of the day planner. One other suspicious bit found in the planner was a card for a ladies' escort service called Ladies en Confidant, and this oddly lined up with some items from the evidence scattered along the highway, including flyer ads for a company called Models Inc. And with this information in hand, they got a new revelation out of boyfriend and high school sweetheart Ron Biegler, who told police that Paige saw clients for a high-class escort service. And she utilized some of the remaining spoils of her husband's wild spending to make it a really high-class escort business. And she did this to pay for that massive mortgage that she had to pay every single month. So she went by the name Carrie, and the business was all her own. She called it Models Inc., but she was the only model on staff. She charged up to $1,000 a session. She kept this a secret from everyone in her life except for Ron Biegler and a couple of very close friends. And she kept life as normal as possible for her kids. And they, of course, had no idea what she was doing to keep bills paid and food on the table. And people in the community learning this turned against Paige and wrote editorials in the paper asking why they were continuing to care about and search for a dead hooker. Their words, not mine. And the fact that people still look down on doing what you want with your body for money is pretty ridiculous. The Models Inc. phone service had a call-in message feature, and a number of clients called in the day that Paige went missing and around the time that she was missing.
Yes, this is Buddy. I was wondering if you had any girls available this afternoon.
Hey, this is Jim. I'm going to go get me a motel room now.
Hello, my name is Bill. Just calling to see if anybody's still available for the night.
And all of these men could be suspects in her disappearance. They added six new names to the list of possible suspects, but one man called her 19 times the day that she disappeared. This man is named George Coraluzzo. And Coraluzzo had partnered in a house painting business at one point. And the partner's wife, named Megan Williams, had a lot to say about George. For one, he had been involved in a kidnapping case unrelated to Paige, where a woman testified that George had abducted her and took her unwillingly across state lines. What's more is he had failed to show up for his painting job during the days Paige went missing. And he gave this crazy and morbid excuse that his brother, sister-in-law, and niece and nephew had been beheaded in a freak accident on the Jersey Turnpike. And he had to rush there and deal with funeral arrangements. So when Megan Williams saw the story about Paige's burned out car on the news, she said that she knew George had murdered Paige. Detectives didn't let on when they talked with Megan that they were there to talk about Paige's kidnapping case. And they wanted to know what she knew so they could connect George to the murder of Paige, seeing as he called her 19 times. Megan started having doubts about the beheaded family member story, so she called a New Jersey news stations and even called the coroner. And no one knew about an entire family being beheaded in a freak highway accident. Detectives basically discovered that George was at this party when Megan's car was burned, and they decided they should loosen their focus on him. But Megan was adamant, and she heard that George told people that he had done something so bad that he couldn't live with it, and something apparently bad enough to make him lie about members of his family being beheaded. So investigators talked with George's closest friend, Jose Tavera, and he had an arm injury that was a burn, but they verified that he had actually injured his arm at work as some kind of coincidence. So investigators turned from George to the other clients calling Paige before she went missing. One man who called was a ranch hand, and he called from a Motel 6 while she was missing, wondering if she was coming to the hotel or not, apparently for an appointment that she had previously booked with him. Another man, it was later discovered, was using embezzled money from his job to pay for Paige's services and that of other escorts, but he turned out to be a dead end as well. Another person apparently called from a prepaid track phone, basically a burner phone, which isn't too suspect for someone using an escort service, but this man would turn out to be the weirdest yet, and his name was Lester Ralph Jones. Lester had no alibi the night that Paige went missing, and it turns out that that night he was at an RV lot where he worked across the street from where Paige's car was burned. The weekend before Paige went missing, Lester and his second wife were in California, and then they came back to Grand Junction, and she went on to Georgia while he stayed in Grand Junction alone. So his wife wasn't around to verify where he was either. In Lester's workplace at the RV lot, they found a gas cam that his boss said isn't something that the business owned or used. And they also found a package for a track phone. And the serial number from the package got traced back to a purchase at a Walmart. And they found video of Lester buying the phone. But when they questioned Lester, he said it wasn't him in the video, even though it clearly was. And he could have just said, yeah, I was one of her clients, but I didn't kill her. And it would have been less suspect and made more sense than flatly denying that the video of him buying a phone isn't him. He later changed his story to say that he was actually buying a soda, and then he realized that didn't make any sense, so he said he was buying a Monster cable because the packaging didn't look like a soda, and it looked more like a track phone. But Lester's weird behavior doesn't stop there. They let Lester go and told him that his two cars that they had impounded for evidence were ready to pick up. And Lester's wife answered the phone, and Lester comes to the phone, and almost like he's in a weird stupor, he keeps saying, "You asked me where I should bury a body." And no one asked him that on the phone, or even the day before, so soon enough they found out why he was saying all that, and he had just taken an overdose of sleeping pills, and he had left a suicide note for his wife saying that he didn't do it and he didn't want to be railroaded. But Lester lived, and the investigators were back looking for new evidence. And they brought out scent dogs to try and detect any of Lester's scent, and they found his scent in the burned-out car, remarkably, and on the items found on the side of the road. and they went all the way down a gravel road into the Gunnison River with the scent. And they dove to try to find Paige's body, but they didn't find anything. And slowly, the volunteers started to head home, and the command center set up for Paige sort of just ran cold. But Paige's family realized that they were going to have to dedicate essentially their lives to finding Paige. And eventually her parents did end up leaving Grand Junction to head back to Denver without knowing where Paige was. But a new and unexpected new witness would come in the form of one of Lester's old wives. Lisa Nance and Lester had been married and had some kids, and she remembers Lester gradually changing during their marriage. He eventually started tapping his own wife's phone and tracking her everywhere she went, and she ended up ending the marriage because of all of that. Then later on, one morning as she was driving her new boyfriend to work, Lester Jones pulled up next to her and purposely hit her and drove her off the road. And Lester grabbed a gun and pointed it at Lisa Nance and the boyfriend, who basically ran out of the door. Lester kept babbling to her on the side of this road about her not loving him, and she eventually talked him down and he left. And weeks later, she came out of her bedroom in her home to find Lester sitting on her couch in the dark, and she tried to figure out the situation and how best to handle it, so she suggested that they both go someplace public to talk and have a little date, like out to dinner. And she hopped in the car with him, and he kept on driving past restaurants and out into the wilderness, and he kept stroking her head and telling her that everything was going to be okay. And he eventually told her that, yeah, she was right. They weren't going out to dinner. He was going to kill her. And she eventually convinced him to go to a hotel after he wanted to have sex in the car. And as soon as he went in to book the room, she got behind the driver's seat and floored it from the hotel, and eventually got pulled over by a cop, and she told the cop what was happening. She eventually went back home and got tons of calls from him in the coming days, and he started stalking her mom. And this is when police finally arrested Lester. And because of this entire incident, he served 3 years in jail for assault and kidnapping. So, years ahead, despite the evidence against Lester in the missing case of Paige Bergfeld, the DA refused to arrest him without a body. And the DA claimed that this is because of her double life. There wouldn't be much of a response to a defense saying that she might have run off with one of her clients, and it would be impossible to prove that that didn't happen. So, nothing happened. Craig Bergfeld, Paige's brother, who was and maybe still is a plastic surgeon in Seattle, moved into her Grand Junction home to help take care of her kids, and they all waited for answers. And some answers came on March 6, 2012, when a hiker discovered something that would finally move the case forward. Paige's remains were found, and her father heard it first from a reporter who called him to let him know that Paige's remains were found. She was about 60 miles from where all of the things had been discovered on the roadside, and they could still see duct tape around the jaw and back of her skull. She had presumably been buried, and then weather and rain gradually unearthed the remains. And the papers and personal items that were possibly the start of a trail basically led right to her. They could follow those 13 miles and then 60 more miles to where she was eventually found. So who were they going to charge? George Corluzzo's alibi was there, but it was weak. He said he was at a party drunk that night, and his friends said that there was no way he could drunkenly commit the crime. And what's more, George was now dead after drowning in a river. But for whatever reason, I've never heard of a case that so heavily focuses on making sure the other suspects are not their guy. The investigators and DA decided that they needed to prove without a doubt that George didn't do the crime so that they could go after Lester. They found a video of George's friend at the store buying party stuff at the time that they said they were having a party, and they interviewed a ton more people to establish that George was in fact at that party and very drunk. So now they felt confident enough to take the case to a jury. So November of 2014, They arrested Lester Ralph Jones for the murder of Paige, but they still didn't know where, how, or why she was killed. Was Lester a client who became obsessed with Paige? Did she blow him off and he decided that he didn't like that and decided to stalk and kill her? The trial got off to a dramatic start because Ron Bigler, the former husband and current boyfriend of Paige, apparently said that he wanted Lester to be found not guilty so that he could kill him himself. And he was very angry, and he agreed to keep calm at the trial, and he testified that he and Paige had plans to get a new place, sell the huge, impossible mortgage home, and start anew. And there was a slew of witnesses, possibly too many, to a point where it confounded the case. The defense began to claim that the investigation was shoddy and focused immediately on Lester Ralph Jones without focusing on other clients. And they twisted all of these witnesses and all of these possible suspects to make it look like there was reasonable doubt that it could be Lester Ralph Jones. The prosecution brought this list of former clients of Paige's, all real pieces of work, and they all testified. So the man who called from the Motel 6 testified he didn't kill Paige. The man who embezzled money also testified he didn't kill Paige. A former client who got drunk with his friends one night and told them that if he did kill Paige, he would have used a wood chipper to dispose of her body. He was put on the stand and testified that he didn't kill Paige and that his comments were a bad joke and just drunk and rambling. Megan Williams was even brought up to come on the stand and say that she was convinced that the suspect, George Coraluzzo, was the man who killed Paige, which isn't really a great witness to bring up when you're trying to say that another man did it. Then the original investigator, who was basically removed from the investigation, came onto the stand and admitted that she had lost some crucial pieces of evidence in the case, and she had lost some interview recordings. So this case isn't looking too strong at this point. The jury went through 6 weeks of over 100 witnesses, and the jury deliberated, and they had tons of questions right off the bat, which wasn't a good sign. The jury was deadlocked and not unanimous, so the judge declared a mistrial. The biggest weakness was not knowing how Paige was killed, and no witness ever could place Lester Jones near Paige that night. So months later, in 2016, they had a new trial. And the only difference in this new trial was the closing arguments, where the prosecutor went after each theory and attacked all of the other suspects to explain why the only man who could do it was Lester Jones. And this time, Lester was convicted and found guilty and given a 65-year sentence, meaning he'll die in prison. But there were still so many questions and so much grief. This woman and mother, dead, lived probably the last hours of her life in horrific fear. And she was killed because of one man's obsession with women and inability to be denied. And I feel like there's a strong possibility that Paige isn't the only woman Lester has killed. Considering he almost killed his ex-wife, there's a strong possibility that this wasn't even his first murder, based on how he almost got away with it, and he hid the body well enough that it wasn't found for years, and he destroyed evidence, or at least attempted to. So there's some organization here, and there's a sense of confidence from Lester that I feel like he has to have done this before. Paige's eldest daughter, who made all those phone calls, graduated high school before the final trial, and Paige's children live with their grandparents, and they do have an okay relationship with their dad, Rob Dixon. And Paige's parents live with the grief and questions and are trying to get back to some kind of normal. So that is the murder of Paige Bergfeld. And I'm going to have pictures up on Instagram, as usual, at Colored Red Podcast. And if you guys feel so inclined, head to my Patreon, that's patreon.com/coloredredpodcast. And all you have to do is donate $1 per month and you'll get a card and sticker from me. And that's all for today, guys. Stay sane and until next time.